good morning, good evening. Welcome to Friends to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That snippet opening today's show is from the single called Metta Prayer from the artist Celia. Well, did you know yesterday was Cesar Chavez Day? There's a movie out about him. Did you hear about it? Well, if you don't know who Cesar Chavez is, he's an American activist, a labor organizer from 1927 to 1993. He founded the National Farm Workers Association. And there have been some interesting quotes from him I'd like to share with you. The first one is, once social change begins, it cannot be reversed. You cannot uneducate the person who has learned to read. You cannot humiliate the person who feels pride. You cannot oppress the people who are not afraid anymore. We have seen the future, and the future is ours. He also said, who gets the risks? The risks are given to the consumer, the unsuspecting consumer, and the poor workforce. And who gets the benefits? The benefits are only for the corporations, for the money makers. He also said, we cannot seek achievement for ourselves and forget about progress and prosperity for our community. Our ambitions must be broad enough to include the aspirations and needs of others for their sake and for our own. I like those. I think you probably do too. Well, today we are broadcasting at a very special time because our guest, Foremother Anne Baring, is supposed to be chatting with us from the UK. However, I think she's having trouble connecting, and I'm a bit worried about that. I think I will continue on here for a little bit, but I have a feeling we might have to reschedule. We did a test and all of that. She was supposed to be calling in using Skype. You know, we tested it just a few days ago, and for some reason today she doesn't seem to be able to get through on the switchboard. But we'll give her a few more minutes here because Anne Baring is an incredible foremother, and she has a wonderful book I'd like to chat about, a book that's 20 years in the making called The Dream of the Cosmos, A Quest for the Soul. And this important book came to my attention thanks to a listener who sent a YouTube clip of Anne discussing it with Anne Harvey. You can find it easily, and I recommend you do, especially if I don't get her on the line this morning. Just go to YouTube, and you can put in Anne Baring interview, or I think it might have been called A New Reality. And if you're just learning about the work of Anne Baring for the first time, she's been at this some time. I used several of her books, The Myth of the Goddess and the Divine Feminine, when I wrote my first book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. But those are not her only books, so please check out her website at annebaring.com. You know, she has an extensive bio. I really encourage you to read it. She attended Oxford University. She took off for India and the Far East. She studied Hinduism and Buddhism in her search for the nature of the soul and those nagging questions the intellectually and spiritually curious among us constantly ask, like, who am I? What is life? What is the nature of God? And she comes up with some answers you may be hearing for the first time, or perhaps her answers will confirm your own findings. Whichever, I think we would have a very fruitful interview here if she could just figure out how to get onto the switchboard. So, in the interest of giving her a bit more time, I'm going to go ahead and play the full cut of Celia's song, Metta Prayer, and see if I perhaps have an email from her. Okay, I apologize for this, listeners. If we don't get her on today, we will reschedule. Okay, here it goes. Metta Prayer by Celia, the full cut. About that. I'm not sure why, but I'm certainly glad to have you.
Here I am anyway. That's very good.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Anne. Thank you for your tenacity. I just gave you a lovely intro, and we all had fingers crossed that you were going to be able to make it in. So I really appreciate that. It's all worked out. And let me start by saying that because you couldn't hear the intro, I have your two books, The Myth of the Goddess, Evolution of an Image, which you co-authored with Jules Cashford. I also have The Divine Feminine, which you co-authored with Andrew Harvey. And I've used them both as references in writing my first book, Sacred Places of Goddess. So I was familiar with you as a foremother of the Divine Feminine. And then one of my fans for the radio show sent me your interview with Andrew Harvey discussing your newest book, The Dream of the Cosmos, The Quest for the Soul. And I have to say, Anne, it truly is food for the soul. It speaks to what so many of us are trying to understand and teach so that we might, really raise the consciousness of humanity. So thank you. I know that book was 20 years in the making. Is that not right?
Absolutely, yes. It took me a long time because I had to be old enough to write it. I'm now in my 80s, and I had to wait really between the ages of 60 and 80 to be ready to put something so deep and so difficult into words.
Well, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense because I know myself. I'm 56, and, at this age, I kind of feel like I have the ability to see things and feel things and understand things that, maybe I didn't have 20 years ago. And no doubt, when I'm an elder such as yourself, I hope that wisdom will only deepen. So thank you. Thank you for the contributions, you've made over the years. And so, let's get started. I listened to your interview with Andrew several times, took notes, read several chapters of your book, which I can't wait to just read it from cover to cover. And I have some of the list of things you wanted to make sure we don't forget to chat about. But let's start with defining the sacred feminine. I remember you said in the interview you feel it's more than what feminists are attempting to do in empowering women or just the attributes of sharing, caring and nurturing or sexual attraction. You call her, I think, the anima mundi, the soul of the world, the sea of being penetrating everything. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yes, I will, although it's quite difficult to explain. But I think what's happening now, what I call this new perspective on the feminine or the feminine, the divine feminine perspective, is really recovering something that we've lost a very long time ago, which is the idea that we live in a sacred earth and a sacred cosmos, and that we need to attune our consciousness to that sacred earth and sacred cosmos instead of seeing ourselves as separate from it. So I've defined the feminine really as this new perspective. It's part of the feminist movement is part of it, and also the awakening of women all over the world and the attempts to free them from their long marginalization, really. It's part of it, but it's much, much deeper than that, because it goes to the old Platonic idea that the soul has the cosmos has a soul, and that the earth has a soul, or a consciousness, if you like, which is perhaps easier for us to understand, and that we are part of that soul or that consciousness. We're not separate from it. So this is what I'm trying to bring back with that definition of the feminine as a new perspective on life. That it's really an old perspective that's coming back into our consciousness, but in a much at a higher level, if you like, or a higher level of the spiral.
Right, right. Well, you say that we got away from the divine feminine. We went from a humanity that revered the moon to one that venerated the sun, from a culture that saw the sacredness of all life to one that had disdain for the material world and nature. Can you speak to how the Abrahamic religions and their attempt to degrade matter played a role in redefining divinity, you know, leaving us with kind of an incomplete view of God-Goddess?
Yes. That, again, is extremely difficult, and that's why that book took so long and is so long in itself to explain it. But I think what happened around 2000 BC, there was a big shift of consciousness. For about 25,000 years before that, the Great Mother had been worshipped. And then there was a sort of in-between phase of goddesses and gods, where you still had a very strong emphasis on the great goddess, or the goddesses, say, of Egypt or Mesopotamia. But then gradually, particularly in Hebrew culture, there came into being the idea of this single male deity who was quite separate from the earth, quite different from the old mother goddess image, the great mother of earth and cosmos. And so gradually, the idea developed that this god, this male father god, was distant from the earth, was a distant creator. He didn't bring forth the whole of creation from his womb, so to speak. He created it through the word, and that is quite a different context for understanding how we came into being. It really put a huge gulf between, or an abyss between, us and the creator god. And I think this is, to me, it's the root of all our trouble today, that we've become completely separate from the divinity, seeing divinity or the divine as something quite separate from ourselves, whereas older cultures saw it as penetrating every aspect of the visible world. It was present within the world, present within the forms of nature. So now we're sort of stuck with this image of a totally transcendent god who, we're told, loves us and cares for us, but we haven't got a feeling of relationship with the earth as part of that spirit, as part of that God. And this is what I think we have to correct. It's a huge correction, and it's going to take some time and a lot of effort, but I think it can be done. If I made that clear?
Yes, yes. And let me sort of delve into that a little bit. You know, it seems this year, and maybe, you know, I'm hearing more and more people talking about, you know, quantum thinking, different levels of reality, that goddess is really consciousness. Some people have described it as almost like the Akashic Record or the laws of the universe. You know, some people have said, you know, yes, you know, it's out there, but it's really indifferent to us. It really doesn't care about us. So I guess I want to ask you, in your wisdom, what you've gleaned over the years, you know, especially since I heard you tell Andrew that you believe that we're maybe even getting some help. What do you think that consciousness out there is something that does care about us, that intercedes in our lives, or of all of us who, you know, go to church on Sunday or pray at our home altars, you know, is it futile? You know, does the consciousness of the earth really care about us?
I think it does, absolutely, because we're part of it. We've forgotten that we're part of it. And it's just like a mother with a child. A mother's not going to abandon the child. She's not going to say, I don't love you anymore, get out, sort of thing. I really do feel that the universe as a whole, or the cosmos as a whole, has a deep concern for this planet, is really seeing, longing for us to wake up to a different understanding of reality and a different understanding of the presence of the divine in everything. And in our own nature as well, deeply buried in our own nature. So, and also another thing is that we've lost the idea of the existence of several dimensions of reality, and that we move from this phenomenal world, which is the densest physical level, if you like. When we die, we move into other levels of reality. We don't die in our consciousness. We only die in our physical body. And this understanding has been totally lost. It was once part, very much part of shamanic cultures, but it's been lost in our Christian culture. Although we say that we don't die, but we have no idea of what these higher dimensions are and how easy it is to move into them once we know that they exist.
Well, and that's one of the things I've read, that's one of the reasons humanity or patriarchy put aside the sacred feminine, because the sacred feminine was the cycles of life, and man wanted to deny his mortality, so to speak, you know. I don't know if you agree with those thoughts, but I'd love for you to share a bit more about these other dimensions. You know, if you have a, you know, if you have an intuition, an inkling, or you've been given some dream, I know your dreams have been very prophetic. What can you tell us about what happens to us beyond death, beyond what you've just said?
Well, obviously, all of us have lost members of our family, either a parent or a partner or a child. And so we've thought about these things, but there's nothing to tell us what exists beyond the threshold of death. And I happen to have a client of mine who lost her husband a couple of years ago and was deeply, deeply distressed. And because she was so distressed, she began to look on the internet for all kinds of proof of our survival. And I did the same to help her. And so that really expanded my understanding of what goes on beyond our death enormously, because there's a huge amount of information out there which is not acceptable to science. But that doesn't matter. It's there. And I think science has a block about it, a psychological block, because it's non-rational. But to me, it's utterly rational. And it's something, I mean, I feel all the time I've been writing these books, I have felt helped by beings on the other side. Historical beings like philosophers and people from my own family and all sorts of other people, even angelic beings. And I'm absolutely convinced that they exist, and that there's only a thin barrier now, really, between our world and that world. And if we can just focus a bit more on that barrier and dissolve it, we'll have a much happier life in this world, because we won't be so frightened of death and so full of grief when we lose our loved ones. I think this is very, very important, and I've seen how this client of mine has really become much more balanced, and she's even begun to translate things from English into French, because she's French, through her understanding of what she's found on the internet. It's very interesting. So this is how we can help each other, I think, and we shouldn't be frightened of mediumship. We shouldn't be frightened of all the books that have been written by people from the other side, which you can find on the internet. You can find it, I think, on my website at the end of chapter 19 of my new book, Dream of the Cosmos. You'll find the references there of books and websites that you can go to that would help you. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. It's a start, and you know, I believe you you said you know, this sort of a segue. It ties into this. I believe when you were talking to Andrew, you made the comment that the sacred masculine is sort of the knowledge we have in the moment, you know, whatever that is, and the sacred feminine is the intuition, it's the inspiration that, she goes out and collects that, and she brings that to the sacred masculine that sort of enhances his knowledge base, so to speak. And to an extent, I think that's what you're saying, that these people who are these mediums or these people who are more sensitive that have had the ability to maybe see the other side, we have to stop dismissing our inspiration and our intuition for just the things that we can prove. Because, you know, that's part of how we develop and learn. So these people who maybe have these experiences when they pass, that they see this light. You know, maybe that light that we hear over and over again, you know, going into the light, maybe that's simply passing from this dimension in our physical body into the next. You know, your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I think the whole experience of the near-death experience, there have been so many now and so many postings on the internet about them, that it should really give us enormous confidence in our survival, because I think that what happens when we die is pretty well what happens with the near-death experience, that we move into the light, we cross a threshold, we are met by either a member of the family or somebody whom we know who takes us across that threshold and kind of introduces us into this other world that we're moving into. And all the time, there's a very ancient knowledge or awareness that we have a subtle body as well as a physical body, or if you like, a soul body, if you want to call it a soul body instead of a subtle body. But that subtle body or soul body is what we live in when we die. It's here with us when we're here, but we don't know about it. But when we die in the physical body, we move into that soul body, and it's that body that we live in those other dimensions. And that gives us great comfort, I think.
I think so, and I can't help but think, hearing you say this, that maybe when we have dreams of a loved one who's passed, you know, maybe that's still yet another way that they can penetrate, you know, penetrate the different dimensions, you think?
Absolutely, because if we took them seriously and said, yes, this is a message coming to me from the person who's passed over, it should give me great comfort and feeling of connection. And also one could write down the message that may be coming through from that person when you wake up. Just write down the words that come to you. And that can strengthen the connection.
Right.
You know, you have to build on it. Just like writing down your dreams helps you to remember them, whereas if you don't write them down, they tend to just disappear. So
yes.
If we write down what we think we're hearing, it strengthens that connection.
Well, in speaking of penetrating the dimensions, you talked about the Shekinah, and it seemed that archetype of goddess, from hearing you talk, you felt seemed to convey the essence of the sacred feminine perhaps better than others. I believe you described her as the inner penetration of both worlds. Did you want to elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, is
yes.
She really different than, say, Demeter or Isis or Artemis?
Yes, she's very, very different, because she comes from the tradition of the Kabbalah, which is the Jewish mystical tradition. And the idea of that tradition, which I found so interesting, and that's why I put a whole chapter into my book on it, is that there is a divine unity between the male and the female, or the goddess and the god, or the divine masculine and feminine in the ground of being, in the divine ground. And then from that divine ground, the Shekinah goes forth, as it were, emanates through all the dimensions and realms of being until she manifests in this world, or even as this world. She's there with us, so to speak, as the ground of being of this world, which is the same as the anima mundi, really, of Plato and Plotinus. So the same idea there is that this divine being emanates through all the worlds and dimensions until it either creates or lives within the world that we're living in. So we're not, in this sense, she loves and cares for what she's bringing into being and what is emanating from the divine ground. I think it's such a beautiful image. And also, as we wake up and as our souls or sparks of her being we are, sparks of light of her being, as we wake up and are able to return to the divine ground, so she is able to rejoin her vows or the divine masculine or the divine male image of God in the ground, so to speak. But it's all one. It's not. I can't explain it really because it's such a mystery. But,
yes.
She is present with us here.
Well,
as a person.
But that does then beg the question. That's a beautiful way to look at Shekinah. But what about the people who tend to be more drawn to the other goddesses? Where do they fit into this goddess cosmology. Or, you know, I've a friend of mine, Jenny, who goes to wisdom circles with me, you know, she usually describes the goddess as like one diamond, and all of the different goddesses or facets of that diamond. Now, you're sort of setting the Shekinah apart a little bit. So I'm wondering, how do you see the other goddesses? What roles do they play? Are they as important as the Shekinah?
Well, I think it's very difficult to be precise, and one shouldn't interfere with people's beliefs. But to me, these are all names, whether it's Demeter or whether it's Hathor or Isis or whether it's Artemis. These are names that were given to the powers that people felt, and names that they gave to the aspects of nature that they felt related to. But the Shekinah is really different, because she was speaking here about the divinity of the divine ground itself, which is so far away from our understanding of what it might be. But I think that the goddesses that that you've just mentioned, you can say that there are aspects of that divine feminine, but the Shekinah is the divine feminine itself, or not. It's not a form, really. It's a concept or an emanation or a presence, much more
okay.
than the other goddesses are. But they were believed in the times when they were believed in. Obviously, they were felt as a presence in that time, that where there was no concept, say, of the Shekinah, then Demeter or Aphrodite or whichever the goddess people worshipped was very real to them and very important, and also kept them in touch with that essence of the other dimensions.
Okay.
So they were important. Okay?
Of course. And let's shift gears a little bit. I find it really important, I think, to talk about the collective versus the personal shadow. You mentioned that we're obsessed, you know, patriarchy, the culture we live in. We're obsessed with the myth of progress, domination, heroes, the warrior ethos, and you know, how war has become normal and fashionable. You know, I think you even described it as the psychotic masculine. Could you explain that to my listeners, please?
Yes, well, this is, again, very difficult, but it's based on a culture of fear, and that culture of fear began to come into being about 4,000 years ago, and we've had nothing but wars and empire building ever since. And this is a habit. It's a habit of the male psyche that's come into being over those 4,000 years, and it's extremely difficult to see it as a pattern of behavior that needs to be overcome. And this is why it's become psychotic, because if you're, I mean, look at Syria, take Syria today, look at the death and the destruction that's going on there and the ruin of the cities and the massacre of civilians and the rape of women and all that. That is psychotic behavior. But it's taken as normal because war has been treated as something normal, which it is absolutely not. When people kill other people, they're taken over by the predator in the psyche, if you like, because we've inherited that pattern from the dinosaurs. We've got it from way, way back. It's part of our nature, but it can come out when we think we have a justified cause to kill other people. But nevertheless, it's a psychotic pattern that we slip into there. And this is something that Jung emphasized again and again, the emphasis on becoming conscious of our shadow and how the shadow can take us over. It can take possession of the conscious mind, as we see in Syria. I mean, that is a state of possession that we're looking at there. And
right.
It's a state of possession when we went into Iraq as well.
Well, and you even a quote you read from the Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, talking about how our religions are so full of this violence. The Ayatollah Khomeini said, "A religion without war is an incomplete religion." And you know, I you know, we look at the Christian Crusades, and you know, so it's not just Islam, is it? You know.
No, it's deeply embedded in our own history, and we're only just pulling out of it now. People are beginning to question now. Whenever war comes up, sort of thing, they're now protest movements saying that they don't want to have war. But this
right.
is a growth consciousness, which is very positive, I think. But But so you're absolutely right. It's not only in Islam, it's in Christianity, it's in Hinduism. It's even in Buddhism a little bit, not so much, thank goodness. And it was in Judaism as well. I mean, the whole thing was about the great battle between good and evil. And we began to see our enemies as evil and name them as evil and thought we had the right to attack and kill them. And if we could grab their territory at the same time, so much the better.
Well, Anne, you know, let's talk a little bit about good and evil. You know, it's, I know myself, I'll be honest, you know, I struggle, I struggle trying to love my enemy, you know. I think maybe we all do. You know, here in the United States, you know, we're so polarized politically. You know, we have the left and the right, you know, conservatives and fundamentalists and liberals, and, you know, we all feel like we're on different planets. And I guess I just wonder, you know, I try to always ask my guests who I know are probably more wise than me, how do we bridge that gulf? You know, how do we love the Republican that's trying to take away contraception and abortion and doesn't care about feeding hungry children and but always finds money to go to war? You know, how do we manage that? You know, and is good and evil just an illusion? You know, that we've created in our own minds?
No, I don't think it's an illusion. I think good and evil definitely exist. And as I've said, what's happening in Syria is evil. It's clear as the nose on one's face that killing other people is evil. And when you come back to the situation in the United States with the polarization there, I think that we don't necessarily have to love the opposite numbers, but we have to understand what has made them be the way they are. And why they're caught in this polarizing mythology. This is something that if we ourselves can detach from the polarizing effect of that mythology, of the battle of good against evil, seeing our opponent as evil and seeing ourselves as good, then that detachment gives us an element of freedom in how we relate to the other side and how we speak to the other side and how we speak about the other side. If we can understand that there's a context which is beyond either that we need to relate to, and that context is what is the best for the planet, bringing in a planetary perspective, then it puts our small fights and battles into greater perspective, really. And we don't become so involved in battling it out and exchanging really nasty words and even deeds with our so-called enemy. It's very difficult. I mean, we have the same situation in England with polarization of the parties here, and in many other countries it's the same thing. But we're all struggling for consciousness now. We really are. There's a great battle for consciousness against unconsciousness. And that is really the battle between not so much good and evil, but between moving to a more enlightened perspective on life and staying stuck in the old pattern.
Right, right. And, you know, we've had, you know, scholars on the show that talk about, you know, there's even a physical difference in our brains between, say, for instance, liberals and conservatives. You know, the amygdala, I think it is. You know, some people are just naturally more fear-based, and being more fear-based, you know, they may support familiar institutions even if they're oppressive rather than try new things, because trying new things is just a little bit too scary, you know, for them. Even if we just maybe understand it on that level, maybe it helps us understand, you know, why they, you know, come from a different perspective.
That's right, because that amygdala is, as you say, very important in triggering fear and the response to fear. But that, again, is an old pattern coming from the instinct. And that, if we can understand where it's coming from, we can separate a bit from it so that it doesn't have to take us over. And it's just a question of greater consciousness. And you have a lot of writers in America. I think Daniel Goleman was one of them, who tried to really bring this through to people. And I think if politicians read more books like that, they would be able to detach a bit from their agendas and realize that it's not a matter of life and death that they win, but that it's a matter of life and death that they learn how to communicate with the other side in what's called conflict resolution. So I think that's terribly important.
Well, I agree with you, but sometimes I think, our politicians aren't there necessarily to serve the public good. I think they're there to make contacts, to make money. I think we almost have to find if we could take the money out of politics, then, you know, maybe we could actually get politicians who really wanted to do the best for the country rather than themselves or just maybe their party or their ideology.
Well, you're absolutely right. And as I said, we've got the same problem here. People are disillusioned with politicians because they can see that they're stuck in their own agendas and they're not really caring for what happens to the people. But I also think that the media plays a huge role here in accelerating or emphasizing the differences between parties and people and accentuating this polarity that I'm talking about. If they can whip it up in any way they can, they do, making the situation much worse than it need be if they just all shut up about it.
Right,
do you know
right.
What I mean?
They just throw fuel on the fire and stoke the hate.
Yeah, they love,
you know.
They love a battle, and that's the same old pathology that I'm talking about, this battle.
Right.
Between good and evil, and they bring it right up into the consciousness all the time, and they don't attend to what really needs doing, caring for people and whatever it might be, building more houses or seeing that people have enough food. Those things get neglected in this battle.
Right,
power.
Right. Well, let's shift a little bit into some of the other parts of your book. You talked about the alchemical tradition and how it's really the science of the transformation of human consciousness, that's the true gold, the marriage of light to body and psyche.
Yes, well, the alchemical tradition is really the underground stream that runs through the Christian tradition, if you like. It includes the things that Christianity has neglected, which is to bring together the masculine and the feminine archetypes and also bring together the conscious mind with the deeper elements of the soul. We carry these two aspects of ourselves in our one psyche, so to speak. We carry the conscious mind and we carry what Jung called the unconscious mind, which is really the soul. And these two parts of ourselves need to be brought together. And alchemy, in its extraordinary language, was really working on this transformation of consciousness, which results when you bring these two parts of the psyche together. And they did it in the form of the king and the queen. So the king, which is the conscious mind, has to go through this transformation. But the queen, the unconscious mind, or the soul, or the heart part of ourselves, also needs to go through a transformation because it needs to wake up and strengthen its wisdom, if you like, and its intuitive insight, so that the king and the queen can marry each other and produce a different kind of consciousness, which is called in alchemy the divine child. And that's really going back to the Christian tradition is the birth of the child that is in the Christian tradition, the birth of the Christ. That in alchemy is this birth of the new consciousness from the union of the king and the queen, or the two aspects of our own split consciousness, so to speak.
So when we hear the Holy Grail, the Philosopher's Stone, the Sacred Marriage, are those all phrases for that marriage of light to body and psyche?
Yes, they are, but they're more than that, because the Holy Grail, to me anyway, is this whole cosmic life or consciousness. It's the vision of the whole. So bringing together these two parts of our psyche gives us the possibility of experiencing the vision of the whole instead of all the fragmented bits that we've been taught and that we've learned over the centuries and the thousands of years of belief. We really need to rethink the Christian tradition, heal the wounds that were created by the myth of the fall and the belief that we live in a fallen world. That's another very important aspect. And bring together this soul consciousness with the mind consciousness. And that also would bring together the left and the right hemispheres of the brain because we're much too stuck in the left hemisphere in linear thinking and polarizing thinking, and we're not enough in touch with the right hemisphere, which is a visionary experience, really. We need to bring those two together so our brain hemispheres are much more balanced and the psyche is much more balanced.
Well, and I want to get back to that before the end of the interview to see if you have any tips on, you know, how we can do that. Maybe if you found ways to do it yourself. But you brought up the myth of the fall. Did you want to explain that a bit? And also, you talk about the sixth great extinction. I want to make sure we chat about those things before you have to leave us.
Okay, well, I'll take the sixth great extinction first, because Sir David Attenborough, who's the greatest biologist, really, of this century, has said that we're in the midst of this great extinction because we're allowing, or what's happening is the extinction of hundreds of thousands of species on this planet because of the life that we're leading, which is very difficult to stop because it's so strong and so powerful, this industrial culture that we have, and our dependency on fossil fuels. And as we know, climate change is really happening now. It can't be denied any longer. And this, again, is part of our attitude to nature that has grown up over these millennia, that nature is not part of us, or we're not part of nature. So that what happens to nature doesn't really affect us. But in fact, we can't survive if we continue to destroy these hundreds of thousands of species. Our species in the end will disappear too. This has not yet really dawned on us. So that's one aspect. The sixth great extinction is what we're in the midst of now, and it's an extremely tricky time, and we really need to see what's happening and how we've become so dependent on fossil fuels and develop technologies, alternative technologies, which can wean us off this dependency on fossil fuels. That's absolutely vital. So that's one thing. But to go back to the myth of the fall, what happened with that myth? It was a myth. It wasn't truth, but it's been taken as absolutely divinely revealed truth. And I think it's had terribly negative effects, particularly on women, because in that myth, as you know, we were expelled from the divine world and relegated or condemned to live in this world, which was vastly inferior. In the biblical story.
So you're talking about what happened in the Garden of Eden, correct? The myth of the fall.
When Eve took the apple from the tree and gave it to Adam, that was the beginning in the story of the fall of man. But I think that's a completely illusionary story that was made up by the priesthood of that time to get rid of the goddess, because in having Eve take that apple, she then could be blamed for everything. She was blamed for bringing sin, suffering, and death into the world and really causing the fall. And that belief has fallen on the shoulders of women right up to the present day, because I think that myth is the root of misogyny and all the beliefs about women, that she's dangerous, that she's a temptress, that she's going to cause a lot of trouble, that man better be careful of what doings he has with her. All that sort of belief rubbish has come from that myth. And I think it's been a terrible, terrible burden on both man and woman, because it's also affected the feminine aspect of man's nature, the intuitive feeling side of man's nature, which has been sort of pushed down out of sight, where all the emphasis has been given to the rational mind. And the deeper instinctive feelings have been really pushed off onto woman and almost demonized there, really. If you look at what's happening now at the abuse of women, violence against women, number of women have killed by their domestic partners, the oppression of women in other cultures, a great deal of it stems from this myth, which is common to all three patriarchal religions, I may say. So I think that's got that off my chest. I feel very, very strongly about it, and I don't think that we needed a redeemer to save us all at all. I think that we save ourselves by the way we behave towards other people and towards the earth.
Yeah, you know, because I'll go out and give talks about the sacred feminine, and they say, well, you know, why do you, you know, why are you still talking about, you know, goddesses that, you know, maybe were around 30,000 years ago, you know? So you really have to connect the dots between losing a feminine face of God and, you know, an income disparity, you know, or female genital mutilation or infanticide, you know, it's that domino effect. That I don't think people catch, you know, right off. And it's so important to understand that, you know, when our society only has a male god, we end up with, you know, an imbalance in the roles of the genders and a domination by the male over the female.
Well, it is quite understandable to see how this came into being, because if you have only a single male god and no feminine companion, as it were, you automatically downgrade woman in relation to man. You can't help it. It's just intrinsic that that was happening.
Right.
And what happened was that everything to do with the feminine, whether nature or matter or the soul or woman, became regarded as inferior to whatever would pertain to the spirit and to man and to mind. Those are the different categories, so to speak. So now we're left today with the result of 2,000 years or more of this belief. And that's going to be very difficult to undo it. And just sticking a female image into the Godhead won't do it. We have to bring into being a different concept of divinity, I think, a different understanding that divinity is not a male or a female god or a goddess, but is something beyond our understanding of spirit as present within the whole created order, if you like, and bringing it into being as something that was intended and something that we're meant to serve and love and feel loved by. It's such a different understanding. And if you notice, all the great religions have put the emphasis on compassion and on love and on wisdom, and those are the three things that we need to cultivate if we're to get out of the fix that we're in. Any act of compassion, whatever it may be, is a step in that direction. Looking after one's child or one's partner or one's neighbor or one's dog or whatever is a step in that direction.
Well, you said, that we have to call for a total revolution of the vision of God, that we have to totally reframe our image of the divine creator or creatrix. Do you actually see, though, I mean, it feels like the true nature of even the Abrahamic religions have gotten hijacked by the people still in their shadow, you know? We have the Pope now who at least has started to come out saying, you know, let's put the social issues aside, let's be more like Jesus. Aside from that, I know you've done a lot of research into science, and I want to go to that next, but are there many religious leaders that are actually trying to do as you're suggesting, you know, revolutionize the vision
yes.
of God?
There's one. There's the Dalai Lama, who says that the only religion we need is kindness. And he has had a huge influence, I think, on the world. And he's a wonderful leader because he has no agenda particularly. He just wants people to be able to love each other more and become more aware of the need to love each other more. He's not preaching about God or goddess or anything else. He just is teaching the wisdom,
yeah.
really. Of compassion.
Well, and you know, and speaking to that, you know, if it to sort of, you know, take that the need for kindness a step further. I recall you said in the interview that science is starting to prove the net of Indra. The universal web of interconnection and relationship. So it's almost as if, you know, the idea of kindness, you know, we can't just worry about our neighbor. We can't just worry about our family. We have to care about everything. You know, we have to be kind to everything on the planet. You know, maybe not just the people in our immediate vicinity, so to speak.
Well, I think that's true. I think that we have to extend that idea of compassion to the planet itself and to how we've been treating it, and seeing that perhaps it's not a good idea that we've been digging up the tar sands in Alaska or even fracking the earth in America to produce gas and things for our industrial needs. I mean, there could be, if one can focus more on alternative sources of energy and develop them, like solar panels, for example, we might be able to show more compassion for the earth instead of sort of raping it and digging it up and extracting whatever we can get from it in a very unconscious and brutal way. So I think that, and also towards animals, we could have a great deal more compassion towards animals and towards children and all the pornography on the internet, for instance. Where's that coming from? What kind of psyche is that coming from?
Right, absolutely. Well, and, you know, and I imagine, you know, in this utopian vision that, you know, imagine if the politicians weren't in the pockets of the oil companies and we really saw all the resources on Earth as owned by the people and it wasn't about making money. You know, maybe that's, you know, some sort of a shift, you know, down the road, you know, if we saw everything as sacred and belonging to all of us and not belonging to oil companies, so to speak, you know, or Monsanto or, you know, Big Pharma or, you know, the companies that are stealing water around the world, you know, if you know, maybe that's part of the vision too, that, you know, should these resources, should we even have to pay for the resources of the earth?
I think you're absolutely right. You put your finger on the spot there, because that is precisely what we need to be thinking, the way we need to be thinking now. How can we bring in a new civilization where the food or the oil or the drugs or whatever don't belong to the huge multinational companies like Monsanto, but belong to all of us? And how do we bring into being a system which is different from the one we have now, which can really allocate the resources of the planet in an equitable way and a compassionate way, so that there isn't starvation in one part of the world and overabundance and huge amounts of money in the other, and also so that we don't spend so much money on arms, trillions and trillions on armaments every year and on defense systems, and that money could be spent on feeding the hungry and developing water systems that could give water for everybody. I mean, there's so much that could be done if we shifted that consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, I think, I've heard stories about the reasons why, you know, people in the Middle East support Hezbollah, for instance, is because Hezbollah gives communities money and helps them improve their standard of living. So if that's true, then it makes sense, rather than pouring money into making the military-industrial complex rich, the money, for instance, we just spent on the Iraq War. What if we spent that money building schools and hospitals and uplifting people's standard of living? Not only would the United States be looked upon as, generous and, you know, walking their talk and a Christian, you know, more like Jesus, so to speak, caring about the poor and the least among us, but there's just so much hypocrisy. You know, it's everything is just so turned on its head. I mean, how can we expect to not have a backlash when we always feel might makes right? You know, and
well,
instead of really.
Again, Karen, you're absolutely right. The question is, I think that it has to begin in a small way in communities all over the world, which I think it is starting. I'm in touch with people who are in touch with other movements all over the world, and it is starting in small groups here and there, and getting together, communicating through the internet, and bringing into being this different way of looking at everything. But it is a struggle. I mean, you remember the fight with the dragon. This is the dragon. And this is the fight that we're in with that dragon. which we've created. I mean, we've created it without being aware that we were creating it, but now we're actually faced with it. And the more we can see what needs to be done in the way you've described so brilliantly, I think, the more we will know how to act in individual communities, say, all over America, but all over the world. And this is the net of Indra, if you like. This is a new web of life that we're creating, where we're all connected with each other with the same intention or the same wish, really, to bring a better world into being and not be in the hands of these great power wielders who've been cracking the whip for too long, really.
Right, right. Well, thank you for going back to. Well, thank you for going back to the net of Indra, because I wanted to go back to this idea. So that comes from the Hindus. You know, they and correct me if I'm wrong, because you know you're the scholar on this. I'm just catching up to a lot of these different concepts myself. But the net of Indra comes from the Hindus, where they've always taught this idea of oneness, our interconnection. And I know you've done a lot of study of the new sciences that are coming along, that now we actually have science that is being able to prove what the mystics and the intuitives have always believed. Do you want to speak to that a little bit? Because I thought that was rather exciting when you were talking to Andrew about it.
Yeah, well, I can't talk a lot because not being a scientist, I'm not really qualified. But the idea of entanglement, for instance, is one scientific idea I find very interesting, that everything is entangled with everything else. You can't really separate out the part of what life is from any other part. And that if you have a photon of light this end of the cosmos, it affects something at the other end. So that's the idea also of oneness coming through. But also, I mean, science is discovering so much now and is so excited by what it's discovering that it, goodness knows where it's going to take us. But it was stuck for quite a long time until very recently. But what seems to be coming through is that certain scientists are really looking at consciousness as being the ground of the universe, not something that we've created with our own physical brain, but something that is the whole ground. And it's only a step from there. If they would connect with the metaphysical traditions, then they would realize that there is the divinity of that ground underlying everything. And if the oneness in the Eastern tradition, I'm going off science a bit, for the moment, the oneness, the concept of oneness in the Eastern tradition comes from the fact that the whole of life is divine and that we, as it were, are part of that divinity. We carry that divinity within ourselves, and that is the reason or the explanation of our oneness. We're all united by this divine thread running through all our lives and through everything that we see and that we are. And I think that science is just beginning to move into that sort of understanding. It will have to do it with its own language, obviously, and its own methodology, but it would help it so much if it would connect with these metaphysical traditions which have known about this other way of looking at reality for thousands of years, particularly the Hindu tradition. And the net of Indra is such a marvelous image of the connection of all of us. We are all pearls in this great net of being, connected with each other like a shining web of connection, if you like. And if we could only realize that, we could change the way that we behave, I think, on this planet. And I know that there are other worlds waiting for us to wake up to this, really. They're waiting for the planet Earth to wake up to what they themselves understand. And if there was more communication between us, they could teach us so much if we just asked for help. So that's as much as I can say about science. People listening would have to read my chapter on that, because my memory is not good enough to remember what I've said.
No, I understand. And, you know, you've been very generous. Your whole book, it seems, the entire book is actually there on your website. Is that true?
Yes, because I felt that I didn't know if I could find a publisher, so I put it up on the website for people to read if they found it or wanted to read it. Now that the book is out and I found a lovely publisher, I've still kept it up because some people may not be able to afford the book and they can read it there.
Well, that was very generous. That was very sacred feminine of you, Anne. I think of us as the cognitive minority. You know, we're kind of, you know, we think we have some of the answers. We're trying to wait for the rest of, you know, humanity to kind of catch up to some of these ideas that we believe in. I guess I'm just wondering, we hear about the morphic fields, the 100th monkey. Do you believe that we only need a small percentage of humanity to shift the paradigm?
Yes, I do. And one of the great Indian teachers, Maharishi, I think he was called, who taught the Beatles, he said that it just needs a few people in each community to wake up to affect a much wider field. And I think that 100th monkey syndrome has been really increased enormously by the internet, by all of us communicating instantaneously with each other, ideas spreading, communities connecting with each other, individuals connecting with each other. All this accelerates enormously, this change of shift of consciousness. Absolutely, I'm sure of that. And that's one very positive aspect, I think, of our lives today. And I think the internet has just come in the nick of time to help that, because without it, I don't think we could have done this. We couldn't have the shift of consciousness that's going on now.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about that, the Jesus Christ Superstore, the movie, and at the end where Judas is dancing and he says to Jesus something about, you know, why didn't you wait to come later? You know, because of mass communication, you could have reached a whole nation. And, you know, here we have the internet. So, I've exhausted all the questions I had for you. You are a brilliant mind. I'm sure there's something you'd like to share with listeners I just hadn't thought to ask you.
I think I would just like to share hope, because I think that people get very depressed and discouraged living in this culture, and they get frightened also. And I think that we were told in the messages we were given, because that's one thing we haven't talked about, messages my mother received when I was a child, we were told to really concentrate on the light, focus on the light, see the planet surrounded by light, see our own lives and our own bodies surrounded by light, and see ourselves as a diamond in our heart, which is radiating to all the people that we know. So I want to just leave you with that idea, that image of a diamond in each one of our hearts, and radiating that love and compassion out into the world, because that really is a force, it's an energy that can actually change things. Okay?
Thank you so much
for inviting me.
Anne, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. And I want to just tell listeners your website. Listeners, her website is her name, annebaring.com, and it's Anne with an E. Please go to the website. She has immense information there. Look at all of the books that she's written. This one, probably most importantly, 20 Years in the Making. Anne, thank you. Thank you for sharing your insights, your wealth of knowledge. Thank you for being the person you are on the planet today, you know, to help us raise our consciousness and become better versions of ourselves. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Karen, for inviting me. It's a great privilege to have shared this talk with you. Thank you.
All right.
Goodbye.
Well, listeners, wow, what an incredible foremother Anne is. I am just so privileged that she would spend the time with us today. So I hope you will go back and listen to this interview more than once, and go to her website and see the wonderful things that she has there, because trust me, it will be well worth your time. I think Anne has shared a lot of answers and answered a lot of questions for us today, and at the same time giving us a roadmap for how to potentially be in the future. So as we come to the threshold of, you know, as we cross the threshold into the second part of the show, actually, if I can get my switchboard to work here, I have to thank Joe Carson for her help to help me keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air with her commercials about her wonderful documentary and book, Dancing with Gaia. So if you would please give a listen.
The psychic state of the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, what's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected, they were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that's some of the dialogue from the wonderful documentary, Dancing with Gaia. And it's only $20. You can find out more about it at dancingwithgaia.com. The documentary comes with a mini book and definitely something you should have in your library. And speaking of books and libraries, my new book, Goddess Calling, is out now, and Amazon has it for sale at a discount of $12 and a bit of change. I hope you'll go online and purchase it. It's also an e-book. And please write a review. I still don't have anyone reviewing it on Goodreads yet. It only actually came out in the month of March. But I could use some good reviews there. And you know, the subtitle is Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology, because I do believe the ideals of the sacred feminine are what will liberate us, they are what will change the planet. You know, these values are very much, you know, what we need and much of what we talked about with Anne. So, as we come to the close of the show tonight, or today actually, I'd like to close with what so many of you have told me you like to hear, and it feels appropriate. So I will share it with you again. It's the mission statement of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. It goes like this. Adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on the show I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, ideal, or consciousness. And I know you are too. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity men and women, to throw off the shackles of the past, to look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be so turned on their head and unnatural, and we are going to go about setting things right. And I'm getting that image that Anne suggested, that we see in our heart a diamond, and radiating out from that diamond is kindness. So why do we do that? Well, because if we want to save ourselves and Mother Earth, our beloved Gaia, then we have no other choice. If we want to live in a world of balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, equity, fairness, partnership, collaboration, it is women and our like-minded brothers armed with these ideals of the sacred feminine who will set things back on course. And we talked about Gandhi. Anne said she thought Gandhi was the man with the message. His quote is one of the quotes I think represents the show. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Yes, I think that's what we have ahead, dear listeners, and in some respects, we're probably right in the middle of that. So as we come to a close tonight, please don't forget the three F's. Please click the follow button on my show page so you don't miss news of the wonderful guests that come on the show and share insights each week. The second of the three F's is to become a friend of the growing family of Voices of the Sacred Feminine listeners across the globe. The third F is for Facebook. Please like my pages on Facebook. There's a page for Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio and also my three books, the newest one, Goddess Calling, also Walking an Ancient Path, and Sacred Places of Goddess. So that all said, I want to remind you of the freebies on my website, especially right now as we're in spring. If you go to my website, KarenTate.com, go to the store page, scroll all the way down to the bottom. While you're there, if you're feeling kind, leave a donation to help me keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air, but also avail yourself of the free meditations that are there. There's a wonderful meditation for spring. There's another one about visiting the Isis Temple, another about wonderful goddess Sekhmet, who I feel particularly close to, who's taught me tenacity, strength, courage, and passion. So I guess that about does it for today, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for your listener loyalty. As I always say, you are gas in my tank. I love hearing from you. Please don't stop communicating with me. It helps me know there's someone out there listening. And I hope you enjoyed Anne today, as I certainly did. Please share her interview with your friends on Facebook, and if you're still on Yahoo groups or listservs, whatever way you communicate with your friends and fans. So I think that will do it for tonight. And let me go ahead and close the show with some nice music. I think Arms of the Mother might be appropriate by Abigail Spinner McBride. Here we go. Enjoy.
Evil, Mama, Baja, dear.